Officials say the death toll from Wednesday morning's earthquake has climbed to 159, with the search for survivors and victims continuing into the night.
North Korea's unceasing weapons parade looks to be making headway. Pyongyang launching a ballistic missile from a submarine on Wednesday. Pyongyang calls the drills a practice for an invasion and has threatened retaliation. And it's taking steps to back up that talk.
Ford Motor said Wednesday that it is issuing recalls to fix more than 113,000 vehicles for various defects, including certain of its 2013 to 2015 model year Ford Taurus sedans, Ford Flex Lincoln MKS sedans, Lincoln MKT SUVs, and Ford Police Interceptor sedans.
Hillary Clinton saying there is just no justification for the increase in the price of EpiPen and saying therefore she's calling on Mylan to immediately reduce the price. But she says it's wrong when drug companies put profits ahead of patients, raising prices without justifying the value behind them.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. It is 5:09. Today is Thursday. It's August 25th, 2016. Welcome to another business day. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. One more day. We're there Friday already. What a quick week, right? We've got lots to talk to you about today. First of all, my condolences to all of you White Sox fans who've had to undergo yet another horrible stadium name change to what is it, low rate, guaranteed something or another. It's Comiskey, you know. I have to tell you a story. When I first moved into an apartment on the north side, I'm a Cubs fan, have always been a Cubs fan. I named my dog Wrigley Clark Addison and went to the veterinarian, and the veterinarian took me behind the counter and said, here are all of the Wrigleys. And there was like a file of like 500,000 dogs. Here are all the Comiskeys. There were like 200,000. I'm like, oh, you poor Comiskeys. And then it became U.S. Cellular Field, and now it's low
guaranteed rate field.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
It's terrible.
I know. I feel so sorry for you. So, well, but, you know, maybe this will be the year for the Cubs. We'll win the World Series, and then we'll really be able to rub it in your faces. But we digress. Let's head first to the WGN market desk. Here's your overnight intel from what's happening around the world. First, Asian markets this morning are mixed. A volatile trading day in Asia following a bleak day on Wall Street led by declines in healthcare stocks as outrage mounts over steep prices for those EpiPens. You heard that in our opening montage this morning. It looks like this is going to be headed to a congressional hearing on the matter. Also, we're still waiting to hear what Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen will have to say. Her speech now less than 24 hours away in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Interest rates on the minds of many investors today. Here's what's coming up today on the business calendar. The Labor Department reports on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week. Commerce Department's going to release its durable goods report. Freddie Mac will report on this week's average U.S. mortgage rates. There's another big story today involving Starbucks. A federal judge has thrown cold water on a lawsuit that claims Starbucks defrauded customers by adding too much ice to its beverages. A judge says that he threw out that class action lawsuit in federal court because, in his words, it was a little silly, and so that case is over. You may have seen the big flying bum yesterday. That's what they're calling it in the UK. This big airship that looks like, well, somebody's behind. It crash landed on its just second test flight yesterday in the UK. It was quite a sight with people watching as it crashed into the ground. The vehicle apparently is damaged. They're going to have to go over it and see what happened. But no one was hurt, thankfully, and it didn't blow up or anything like that. But it still was quite a sight to see as this new airship crash lands on only its second flight. Lots of hope for this vehicle because it could be a cheap and inefficient way of carrying cargo. It's bigger than any airship or air vehicle right now on the planet. In Chicago today, one of the people that is out pushing and promoting franchise owners, or franchisees, I guess, is what they're called, is trying to spread the word about something important that I bet you didn't know. And that is that franchise businesses are a part of one of the biggest parts of the economy, growing economy, and that they are hiring more people and contributing more to the economy than you probably think. And we're happy to have Robert Crisani with us this morning. He is the CEO of the International Franchise Association. Robert, good morning. Welcome to the Opening Bell.
Good morning. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
We're happy to have you. I was watching some of the things on your Twitter account last night, and you really get your hands dirty. You were out tossing some pizzas at a pizza place, and it looked like you were even making some fried chicken. Tell us about what you have found and what your association has found in terms of the contribution of franchise owners to the economy.
Thanks so much. I have been very interested in talking to folks in different cities. Chicago is our second stop in a tour that we call At Our Franchise. When we were speaking to our membership, we had a number of different comments coming back from them about how they do things, and it always started with, at our franchise, we do the following. And I think when I talk to public policymakers often, I hear them say, well, how big can this economy be? And they don't understand that we contribute nearly 4% to the gross domestic product of the United States. And the first and most reflexive thing people see all the time with franchising is the fast food. It makes up about 40% of the overall franchise systems. But hotels and healthcare services, doggy daycare. We've got over 300 different lines of business that are involved in franchising.
I was reaching for the numbers in my head. I couldn't remember them, but I have them now. $944 billion, and you're creating jobs at twice the rate of the private sector.
That's correct, and as the rest of any other measured sector. And, of course, we want people to understand the life cycle of so many of the folks that work in our industry. We have a man that is active in our association. He came to the United States at age 32 years old from a place in Pakistan that had no running water and no electricity. And he has over 275 businesses that he owns today. And is a fantastically successful. It's just some 20 plus years later. And the American dream is alive and well. And I think that there's a misconception generally about people going into service sector jobs saying that, I'm not going to go flip a hamburger. Well, there is a life cycle here in these jobs, and it ranges all the way from the entry level position for people with no high school degree, like Aslam in his case, all the way up through ownership of a business. There aren't many places, Steve, where you can start in the kitchen and end up owning one of the shops yourself.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now. Asian stocks were mixed as investors keep an eye on U.S. pharmaceutical stocks after their bad day Wednesday amid controversy surrounding one company. Hillary Clinton may have affected the markets the most yesterday. Her tweet, critical of drug maker Mylan, sent stocks in the company tumbling close to 5.5%. This amid controversy over a 600% price increase in the company's EpiPen. Lawmakers are calling for a federal investigation into Mylan. Investors, meantime, continue to await Fed Chair Janet Yellen's Friday speech, which could indicate whether an interest rate hike is coming. A federal judge threw a lawsuit against Starbucks down the drain. A Los Angeles man sued the coffee giant for fraud and false advertising, saying it cheated customers out of iced coffee by filling cups with ice. The judge said young children know they can get more in a drink by requesting no ice. Also due out today, the July durable goods report and the number of people who filed for unemployment last week. Brian Clark, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 522. Our guest this morning here on The Opening Bell in the studio, Robert Crisani of the International Franchise Association, who's in Chicago today. And Robert, before we get to more questions, I have to play just a clip yesterday because I think your organization got some props yesterday from the head of Dunkin' Donuts on CNBC. Let's listen.
We as an industry have got to work harder at sending out the impression about what a great industry it is to get started. I've learned this morning that Michelle started there.
At Pizza Hut.
Pizza Hut. I mean, it really is the first rung on the ladder. If you want to progress quickly, it's a great industry to get in. It's a growing industry. I mean, I pulled out some statistics this morning. This year, the jobs in the industry are going to grow 3.1%. It's an industry that people forget is the franchise industry is $944 billion.
That is the CEO of Dunkin' Donuts yesterday on CNBC, Nigel Travis, Dunkin' Brands. He's talking about what I think a lot of people already know, and that is, you know, their first job was probably for a franchise owner.
Barack Obama, you know, the president of the United States, got his first job scooping ice cream at Baskin-Robbins. Mm-hmm. The Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, worked the grill at McDonald's during high school. So in all of it, when I go to large audiences and there's several hundred people in the room, I say, how many of you started in fast food or in a franchised business? And you see the majority of hands, certainly of the folks that are of my age, go up in the room.
It's interesting dynamic, because I know that for McDonald's, for instance, I know I've heard from franchise owners that sometimes the relationship between franchise owner and corporation isn't the best. There's sometimes friction back and forth, although that seems to be improving a great deal at McDonald's. But is that a huge problem or a problem for franchise owners, is dealing with that?
Yeah, you know, I think there are a large number of different problems that affect us, and the things you're referring to are problems related to contracts, usually between a franchisor and the owner of the small business locally. And so those are regular business problems that people have with delivery and agreements that they signed up to. And so I think those are not to poo-poo them or in any way, shape or form, because they're serious. But they're not things that I can, you know, my association can solve. We are more focused towards the regulatory side. And so oftentimes when you look at challenges that the industry have, they fall into the categories of, you know, minimum wage, of, the ACA, commonly known as Obamacare, the health care costs that are coming on the industry, and these various new challenges, including joint employer, that are on the horizon for us.
Joint employer, you bring that up because that's a huge issue right
now.
Is that probably your top?
Yes. Yeah. You know, when Nigel is a great leader among our brands, and when you ask people what franchises do you know, Dunkin' Donuts is one that stands out at the very top. There are a handful of the sort of larger franchises, but there are over 3,000 franchised companies in the United States, and we have a issue of the long tail, and many of them have five and six franchised locations. They don't have hundreds or thousands of locations. And this concept of joint employer that has been raised is an existential issue for us. It is destructive and disruptive of the model, and it forces us through a paradigm that has been constructed in someone's mind but doesn't actually exist. And so it is extremely difficult.
Is the minimum wage fight, the fight for 15 as it's being called, is that something that is a big deal for your franchisees?
You know, I think franchisees are very worried about it, and it's, you know, different cities have handled it in different ways, and we have been very active in talking and communicating with community leaders and policymakers on the issue. I have to say that Chicago stands out in that regard, because there were many situations where overreach has taken place in other cities and even in some states, where people said, well, you know, if you're part of a franchise business, then you must be rich, and so therefore you can afford a minimum wage that is higher than the man that's operating the bus, driving the bus, or the guy that's operating the jackhammer. So we're going to force a 30% higher rate of wage on the guy that carries the trays in your store versus the guy that's working the jackhammer on the street. And, it separates us from our customers in a way where they can't afford the food or the services that are provided anymore. And I think it's incredibly unfair. And so we had a conversation with the city council and with Mayor Emanuel here. And I think we were very impressed at the sort of the moderate path that he steered during that process. And so I can't say enough good things about the openness there. Did we get our way? No. Would we have preferred to have drastic minimum wage increase? Yes, but I think businesses in Chicago should feel like they have a government that's listening.
I have a million questions to ask you. Unfortunately, we're running out of time.
Thank you.
So I'm going to pick one in the next 30 seconds, and it's something that I saw the other day. It's this little robot, Pepper, who's working at Pizza Hut overseas now, coming to this country. Everybody's concerned a robot is going to take their jobs, and some of the franchise owners, some of the franchises seem to be at the front and center of that. Is a robot going to take people's jobs?
For the manual jobs that are out there, the robots, the calculations and the work that they have to do, I come from the technology industry originally, so I know a lot about this. That work is incredibly high intensity for calculations. Threading a screw into a thread is incredibly difficult to teach these kinds of things. So most of the manual jobs that you see will continue to be in existence, but they become under greater pressure when you have really high wages. In some cases, it becomes cheaper to maintain one of those robots or to create one. And we've seen them advertised at our conventions and other things with suppliers. So they are beginning to come into the field.
The one downside is that they don't seem to be very friendly and they don't smile a lot.
That is correct, and it's a key. This is the thing that I found here in Chicago yesterday when we went to Auntie Anne's Pretzels. I said, "What a wonderful, nice lady you have out front." And the store manager introduced her to me, and we heard sort of her story. And I said, "With all of the challenges you have every day in your life, that you can be this friendly and cheerfully greet people." She didn't know who we were. She just thought we were customers walking in off the street and for a meeting with the store manager. And it was fantastic. I just the cheerfulness and that's why you go to these stores.
Best of luck to you and your organization.
Thank you.
We appreciate you getting up and coming in and visiting with us this morning. Robert Crisanti, the CEO of the International Franchise Association in town. We'll follow your visit here and hopefully report on some news in the coming days.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Have a great day.
From ABC News, Tech Trends, how 3D printing is helping make lives more productive. Brandy Lee Scott faces challenges completing everyday tasks, things that many of us never give a second thought to.
I have a big issue with doorknobs. If they're round, I have a hard time gripping them to turn the door.
At age 10, doctors diagnosed her with a rare disease that causes tissue beneath the surface of the palm to thicken, resulting in patients having limited use of their hands. Brandy had a lot of trouble finding the right tools to help her. That's when Matter Hackers, a 3D printing company, stepped in. Inspired by Brandy's story, it's sponsoring the Within Reach Design Challenge to come up with more tools to help people just like her. David Gaylord works for Matter Hackers.
3D printing, if you got some design skills, you can solve so many of those issues.
The competition runs through September 6th.
It's really cool that it's spreading the word of this condition because it is a rare condition and not a lot of people know about it.
With Tech Trends, I'm Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It is 5:37. The Olympics are finally over. I know a lot of folks were hopefully happy that they finally came to an end, but others were a little disappointed, including me. I always enjoy watching the Olympics, the spirit of competition, this notion that you can bring together all of the countries of the world in a peaceful way to compete and show off their different cultures. Always very exciting. The games came to an end with a little bit of controversy. We're going to try to avoid that in our conversation as we move forward here on the opening bell this morning. And we're going to bring in somebody who's we've talked to a couple of times before here in the opening bell about the Olympics and about sports in general. And that is, as we move forward here on the show this morning, Ben Fisher is with us. And Ben is a writer for the business, Sports Business Daily Journal. And Ben, I always mess that up and I apologize, but I think I got it right that time. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, right. I work for the Sports Business Journal and the Sports Business Daily. So same basic thing, but you got it right.
Always confuses me. Before we continue on with our conversation, I want to play for you Thomas Bach, who's the head of the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, as he closed out the games in Rio and talked about what was the legacy, what is the legacy, and what might happen going forward.
A record number of 206, all 206 National Olympic Committees participating, plus the refugee Olympic team. Before, 18% of the population had access to quality public transportation. Now with the Games, it will be 63%. You will have a new training and competition center with regard to sport here. You will have the first public golf course in Rio.
And so as our conversation goes on, I'd like to avoid the obvious controversies and all of the other drama that's swirling around this and talk a little bit about what he just mentioned, that is the legacy of these Games. Will there be a legacy, or was this a wasted effort in Rio?
Well, like one of the great benefits from a public relations or a spin standpoint for the IOC is that the Olympics are big enough that there's always a lot of positivity to talk about. And nothing Bach said right there is necessarily inaccurate. I think it's pretty incomplete when we have to talk about the legacy of Rio. He mentions the public golf course. And that's true. Rio never had a public golf course before, and now it will. But one out of every 10,000 Brazilians plays golf, and it's only the very upper crust. So most predictions are that that public golf course will go totally unused. So I'm not sure what of a real legacy that is for the city. The public transportation is a real positive. The city's transit, and it's hard to get around Rio, and that has gotten a lot better because of the Games. But the Rio organizers also promised to drastically increase the amount of raw sewage that's treated before it's sent out into the open ocean, and that didn't happen. And they also promised to clean up and improve a lot of the favelas, the shanty towns that are throughout Rio, and that mostly didn't happen. So it's a lot more spotted than President Bach would have us believe as far as his long-term legacy.
Yeah, and he didn't talk about the financial aspect of this. There are some estimates, including one by Forbes, I believe. I think the Rio organizers or Rio, Brazil, spent about $12 billion on the Olympics, and they stand to lose about $5 billion. So from a financial standpoint, in a country that's already highly impoverished, that jumps out and just smacks me in the face.
Yeah, it's not good. Honestly, as somebody who covers the Olympics sort of full time, I am in the odd position of almost defending those numbers by saying, financially, the Rio Olympics don't seem to be nearly the shambles that, say, the Sochi Olympics were, or like the Montreal Olympics in 76, which went over budget by hundreds of percent and, you know, affected the country's finances for a generation. Rio is overrun like everybody else, but at least comparatively speaking, it's not so bad. Those all-in budget calculations for Olympics are always tough because what is losing money? You know, if the number of Rio residents who now have access to a subway line has in fact grown by hundreds of thousands or millions, you know, maybe that's worth a couple $1 billion being lost to the residents. I mean, you can start getting into complicated public policy questions about what the value of a dollar or the value of a real in Brazil is there. But you're right, it costs a lot of money to host the Olympics, and smart people can disagree over the real benefits of that.
Sure, and because there are the intangibles as well, the attention paid to the problems that you've mentioned. Perhaps now that that's been in the international spotlight, those will be addressed in Brazil. And then there's also sort of this idea, too, that you know people who criticize the IOC for being about money, well, you know, they could have brought the Olympics to America and made a ton of money like they did in Atlanta, but they didn't. They decided to go to South America where the Games had never been before. And so, you know, there's that argument, too, that this really might actually be a culturally, you know, not necessarily a culturally bad organization.
Well, right. And the IOC would insist very strongly that they're not just about a bottom line, that they have a mission that's larger than dollars and cents, and that the idea of bringing the Games to South America was always about proving a point that they are, in fact, a truly global organization and not just a club for the rich elite nations. And I guess the bottom line is, and I probably asked this to 20 people over my 3 weeks in Brazil, was it worth it? I mean, I think we can all agree that an organization that claims to be a worldwide global peace and sporting association should take their prime product to South America or even Africa someday in the interest of true globalism. But it cost a lot of money. It cost a lot of stress and headaches to do it down there. And the question is, was it worth it? And that gets away from a strict dollars and cents calculation pretty quickly into a much less tangible discussion over how important it is to bring something to South America. And that's a good conversation starter when you get some of the sports marketing people from the big sponsors together in a private room where they can speak freely. Was it worth it to go to Rio? And they sort of exhale deeply and roll their eyes and say, I don't know. It was a hell of a month.
Yeah. So. In your writing, you say you weren't prepared for the explosion of sports greatness. And I have to agree with you on that. There was a lot of sports greatness, a lot of people that should have been more in the headlines here that weren't, unfortunately, because of some silliness. And then, you had these refugees who had no country competing under the flag of the Olympics. I mean, that's what it's all about, right?
Right, right. That the creation of the refugee team and some of their stories, that was one of those times the IOC really got it right. I don't say that very often in my line of work, but the IOC saw that as a really great statement to make. And that was the Olympics at its best when they walked into the opening ceremonies. And for the most part, they were non-entities from a competitive standpoint. But you know, the Olympics is the one time a year when we look at something more than just wins and losses. And I think that was a real high point there, for sure.
You see a lot of athletes. You see a lot of competition. What was the best explosion of sports greatness you saw?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'd say in person. Well, I was there for the women's all-around gymnastics when Simone Biles and Allie Raisman finished 1-2. And I guess to a layman who really is a business expert and not a gymnastics expert, I can always watch closely and see something that doesn't go quite right. No matter how good the gymnasts are, they're human. You can always look for something in their routines where just a split second off or something that was slightly imperfect. And that day and all around, I sincerely don't think Biles had a body part out of place at any moment. And it was really, truly spectacular to see that. And of course, when she gets up on the podium for the gold medal and the Star Spangled Banner, it was, the Olympics ideal right there.
And one of the things, speaking of the Star Spangled Banner, that I loved was, I believe it was Usain Bolt who was being interviewed, and another country, the medal ceremony was going on, and they were playing the other country's national anthem. He stopped the interview and said, "Wait, we gotta honor this."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's I think a lot of the athletes have a good sense of propriety about respecting each other's countries. There, Usain Bolt, I mean, he's a young Muhammad Ali, and how he can appear brash and respectful all at the same time, and seems like he's almost a jerk about how good he is, but he's always got a smile on his face. Little moments like that remind us that you can sort of be cocky but not a jerk at the same time. Right. I guess he needs to teach some people some lessons on that.
So, Ben, I don't know if you and I can get together, or maybe you have some strings you can pull, but we have to solve this problem of Olympic athletes who've trained their entire lives, starting as little kids, getting up at this crack of dawn hour, going to a skating rink or going to a track and field place, doing all of this work, and then they have to pay their own way to raise money. They have to do these Kickstarter programs that just scrape to go to the Olympics. I mean, that just doesn't seem right. And then also we tax them on these medals. I mean, really? Can we do something about that?
Well, I mean, like a lot of things in the tax code, it would take about 10 minutes to write and pass a law that would say medal bonuses aren't taxable income. Mm-hmm. Just nobody's done it. And I guess we just got to count on the legislative system to function properly, which is sort of a big leap. But that law is very straightforward. It's just a matter of will, I suppose.
Yeah. And how about this? How about a checkoff on our taxes for a national fund? Hey, I'll give a dollar to the U.S. Olympic Fund to send these athletes to the Olympics. I'd do that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that seems harmless enough. It's not to say that this is a reason not to do it, but, you know, the USOC will not let you forget in their communications that they are the only Olympic committee in the world that is not government funded, that we're not part of a ministry of sport or anything, and it's totally privately funded. And I think to a certain extent that's a good thing, but then you get into profit motive and what the real value of those private funders is to a lot of the individual lesser known athletes, the non-Ryan Lochtes of the world. And yeah, it's not something the private sector and profit margin is profit motive is necessarily going to support. So I think something like that, some sort of tax funded checkoff system, would gain a lot of support and be easy to implement from a legal standpoint. Sure,
we almost made it through the entire interview without mentioning Ryan Lochte's name. But there it is.
It is an interesting situation. If you want to talk about it, we can. But
we're out of time. I think the question I'd like to close with is this notion that people are talking about whether or not the IOC might strip the next Olympics away from Tokyo. Is that even a possibility because of the potential for corruption?
Well, unlike some of the talk heading into Rio about canceling or moving it to the last second, I guess that's not preposterous on its face. It's still far enough out that you probably could make a move. I've seen nothing about the Tokyo situation that would suggest to me that that's remotely necessary. They've had some issues there, but I knowing the IOC, knowing how risk-averse they are, there would have to be much, much more come out in realm of mismanagement or corruption to even begin those conversations in Switzerland at the IOC headquarters. And at this point, I see no reason to think that would happen.
Ben Fisher, it's always good talking with you. Glad you made it back safe from the Olympics. By the way, you can read Ben's work at sportsbusinessdaily.com, and you can also follow him on Twitter at Ben Fisher SBJ. Ben, thanks for being with us on the Opening Bell.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
It's 5:53. Welcome back to the program. On the market desk this morning, Dow futures pointing toward losses when the opening bell rings later this morning, off 35 points for the Dow. NASDAQ S&P futures lower as well. Latest on commodities now, here's Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Soybeans and grains again moved lower yesterday, weighed down by the abundant harvest prospects in key countries around the world. And soybeans led the way lower as the four-day Pro Farmer U.S. Midwest Crop Tour scouted impressive crops in central Illinois, following its observation a day earlier of above-average soybean pod counts in Nebraska and Indiana. Southwestern Iowa's soybean crop, however, looked below average. At the end of the trading day, all the grains were lower. The September soybean contract down a nickel, but new crop November down 9.5. September corn fractionally lower and wheat lower for the day. Then turning to the livestock trade at the Mercantile Exchange yesterday, another down day for the cattle market, the eighth straight day. Yesterday, live cattle futures hit a one-month low, with the August live cattle ending down 52 cents and the October contract down 82 cents. And a weaker hog trade yesterday, too, with the nearby contract down 42 cents. Looking ahead, it's Farm Progress Show next week at Boone, Iowa, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Max Armstrong and I will be on stage with our band all 3 days at 11:30 to 1 in the ADM tent. We hope you'll come by and see us. And coming up this Saturday night, look forward to seeing a lot of you at Streeter, Illinois. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You have a great day as well. As we close out the program, just a reminder of what's coming up on our business day ahead. The Labor Department reports on the number of people who applied for unemployment benefits last week. Also, Commerce Department has durable goods later this morning. Freddie Mac reports on this week's average U.S. mortgage rates. We're also expecting earnings from Chicago-based, suburban-based Sears. Hoffman Estates based. Is it Hoffman Estates? Yeah, I think it is. It's all running confusedly in my head this morning, but Sears reports their quarterly earnings today. We'll be following that as well.